Welcome back. The world was thrown into technological vertigo after the death of Apple CEO Steve Jobs last month. Videos of Jobs' now legendary product introductions replayed across networks and social media, highlighting just how Apple has propelled personal tech forward in just the last 10 years. With a few weeks past, it feels like the right time to consider the identity and future of Apple in the post-Jobs era. Rob Fleischman, our go-to oracle for all things Apple, is here with some predictions on what Apple will come up with next. And Rob, it's great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So, hit us. Can we expect another Apple game changer or maybe just some updates on their already proven innovations?
Well, I certainly don't have any inside information, but I could tell you I'm pretty optimistic that Apple is going to conquer the TV universe next.
Really? Even without Steve Jobs at the helm?
Sure. Well, you know, already on the iTunes store, you can buy videos and programs, TV shows, etc. But I think the TV device itself is really ripe for revolution.
That's funny that you say revolution, because I think of it seems almost backward, you know, from building interactive technology that is beautiful, that already integrates the viewing experience, back to this sit on the couch and flip through the channels.
Well, it's similar to what Apple did with the phone. Think about TV. TV really hasn't changed for the user much in years. People point to high definition. People point to flat screens. But the bottom line is we are standing here looking at an array of rectangular pixels. And what do? We spend our lives plugging additional things into our TV to fix the problems with it. We plug cable boxes in. We plug DVRs in. We're all plugging things into our television to address the problems with it. Our TVs really have become just a simple monitor, just really a screen that we use to view stuff from other devices.
So it's integrating all those things. So if, for example, my phone connected to my computer, connected to my TV, to my camera, so on, is that what we're looking at?
I think something similar. I view it as the following. I think that if I were to guess, I think Apple is going to evolve the iPad into something like a television.
That's what I was wondering, a big giant iPad?
Imagine if you took a giant iPad and stuck it on your wall. Of course, you'd have to have some other advances. For example, maybe every iPhone or iPod or other things could be your remote. Maybe you could use technology similar to the Nintendo Wii, where you're waving at the screen and that's able to control things. But I think something in that direction is probably coming out of the Apple labs.
So from here on out, is Apple going to be asking, you know, WWJD, what would Jobs do? I mean, what are the chances they're going to create an equally compelling identity?
Well, I think for the next few years, I would say at least for the next five, Apple is going to continue to do what it's always done. I think that they have the intellectual capital, they have the people, they have the direction to continue to do what they've been doing. Beyond 5 years, it's really hard to guess. It'll be interesting to see what their personnel does. But I think they have products for the next few years that are going to be great, and they're going to continue to be great.
Well, I understand that you have brought a friend with you today, Rob. Many of you at home may be well acquainted with our guest. Now, we've got her microphone already here. Would you like to introduce Siri to our listeners?
Sure. Let's see what she has to say today. What is your name?
My name is Siri.
Okay, so this is Siri. This is the iPhone 4S. So it's an she talks to you, Siri.
She can respond to some requests with voice. A lot of things she responds to with just displaying information on the screen. But there's quite a few things you can ask her where she'll just talk right back to you.
If your phone were stolen, would Siri respond to my voice, or is it kind of a personal thing?
No, sure. Siri is speaker independent. My phone does know that my name's Robert, and sometimes it uses my name when it answers. But it's a speaker independent voice recognition system. And you should give it a try. Here, I'll hand it to you, and you can just push the microphone button, and Siri will listen and respond.
That's the microphone button
right
there.
You got it. Just push that.
Oh, and then it gives you a script of what you've said. Okay, let's see. Press the button, take my finger off it.
Yep.
Okay.
There you go.
Siri, I have a friend coming in for dinner tonight, and I was hoping to bring her someplace, maybe ethnic, near Concord.
I found a number of restaurants in Concord.
Okay, so if I press one of these, will it tell me about them, or she's just giving me the answer?
She'll give you the answer, and then it'll bring you to it.
Siri, remind me, I have to write a script for Chuck Palahniuk tonight.
Here's your reminder for today at 7 p.m. Shall I create it?
Sure. She understands, sure.
She understood tonight, too. You notice how she pulled tonight into 7 p.m.?
She did. She turned tonight into 7. Okay, all right, this is pretty good. Siri, do I need a raincoat today?
It doesn't look like it's going to rain today.
And then she pulls up the weather report. Oh, this is really good. You can have meaningful conversations. Or can they be meaningful, Rob?
Well, I'm not sure that Siri's quite that smart yet. But, you know, there is a bunch of funny things you could ask her about the meaning of life and how she feels about you. But Siri's pretty limited to its ability to access information on your phone and search the web and look at your calendars and your contacts. Siri, do you love me?
I respect you.
Will you still respect him in the morning?
Will you respect me in the morning?
I don't know what you mean by that. Will you respect me in the morning?
Well, Rob, okay, I can understand the kind of novelty of this, right? You know, showing your friends, doing this kind of stuff. Do you really use Siri? I mean, is it just as easy for you to do a web search and send a text on your own?
You know what I've used Siri for, actually, so far, is when I'm in the car, if I remember something and need to send a message or remind myself of something later, Siri's useful.
How much of a get is this technology for Apple? I mean, we've heard voice recognition. You can do commands to your car, for instance.
Absolutely. The big innovation here is in two areas. First, as you said, voice recognition's been around for a while, and the voice recognition that Siri's using is pretty good. I wouldn't say it's the greatest in the world, but it's very good. It's pretty fast. But that's available on a lot of platforms, and you can buy voice recognition software for your computer, and a lot of mobile phones have it already, and as you said, cars have it. But the real innovation here is when Apple bought Siri the company, they got a technology that allows them really to do some understanding of words. So they got contextual analysis and the ability to take words like sure and understand that that means yes in certain contexts. And that really is a huge win for Apple. And I think they're going to leverage that, and I think they're going to expand Siri throughout all the abilities the iPhone has. And you can imagine, as I talked about earlier about Apple TV, imagine the ability to command your TV via voice. And that's really going to be critical in an area where you might not have a remote. So I think that technology, the two together, are revolutionary.
So you'll be able to say, how come there's nothing good to watch on TV?
Maybe you'll be able to say, show me the things I like, or show me something good on TV, Siri, and it'll be able to take a guess.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today and for bringing Siri along. She's quite entertaining.
It was great fun. Thanks for having me. Goodbye, Siri.
Okay, Robert. See you later.
Rob Fleischman is a serial inventor, entrepreneur, and chief software architect at Zerocol. And Siri, the Apple iPhone 4S personal assistant, is pretty much everything from secretary to know-it-all to stand-up comedian. Siri, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
42 cords of wood, to be exact. Everyone knows that.
That's good.
Coming up, what early naturalists had in common with James Bond, the species seekers that went to extreme lengths to change the worldview of man's place in nature. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the headlines from the BBC. This is NHPR. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 18th century, explorers set out to catalog the varieties of life on Earth. Until then, even educated people believed that monsters and creatures from mythology lurked outside the relative safety of their known environments. Today, there are 2 million documented species on Earth, a far cry from the 4,400 listed by Swedish botanist Carolus Linnaeus back in 1758. Even that number is astonishing, considering that the bold and great lengths a few ambitious men had to go to discover and catalog the mysteries of the natural world. The exploits of these colorful explorers play like adventure stories in a new book, The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth by Richard Conniff. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and guest columnist for the New York Times as well. Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, nice to be here, Virginia.
Oh, this is such a fantastic book, and I'm looking through this marvelous, marvelous illustrations as well. The first species seekers set out to explore the world in the Great Age of Discovery. So describe that time, that backdrop for us.
Well, so for these people, going out to distant corners of the Earth was more dangerous than going to the moon is for us. I mean, first of all, it would take 6 months or a year to get to some of these places. They didn't have any GPS. They didn't have any jets. They didn't have any immunizations. They didn't have any maps. They stood a high likelihood of dying. So Linnaeus sent out 19 of his students. Half of them did not come back. That was fairly typical.
What does it mean to discover a species, and how do species seekers go about it?
Well, it's a tricky question because, people who live in an area have often known about an animal for thousands of years, and then you have some European come in and say they've discovered it. It can be annoying. But discovery means describing a species in detail, showing how it's similar to other species and how it differs and how it fits into a scheme of classification. So it's no longer just local knowledge, but something that can be used anywhere in the world.
Well, there are six main seekers in your book, which reads, as I said, more like a series of adventure stories than scientific narrative. It was a very dangerous pursuit. Some of the side characters are also very fantastic. So let's start with where you start in the book. This is at the height of battle with a certain Colonel Dijon. Tell us a little bit about him.
So he was in the French army, and it was during the Peninsular Wars in Spain, beginning of the 19th century. And he was also a coleopterist. That is, he collected beetles. And the men who were under his command carried little glass vials, and they were told to collect anything on six legs that crawled or flew. And so he was going into battle one day, and he had a challenge of charging uphill into the Spanish cannons. And, the air was full of gunpowder and blood and gore. And he looks down from his horse, and he sees this beetle by a stream that he had never seen before. So he gets off his horse, collects it, pins it inside his helmet, and then gets back on the horse and says, "Charge." And in the ensuing battle, 600 of his soldiers died. His helmet was blasted to pieces, but he survived, and so did that specimen.
But he was actually beat to the jump. That's a sad part of the story.
Yeah, well, this is fairly common. He waited another 20 or 30 years before he actually got around to describing it, and then it was a synonym. That is, somebody else had already described it, and his name was kind of irrelevant.
You write in 18th century London, this fervor that we just heard a little bit about manifested in some very strange journeys of exotic animals. Tell us, for example, why an eel was brought to London in a cask of rum.
Yeah. So they actually shipped five of them from South America, and one of them survived to make it to London. And they were interested in it because it was electrical, and everything electrical was fascinating at that time, Ben Franklin and all that sort of thing. And so they sent back the one that they got finally died before they could do much with it. They sent back to South America for additional samples, and then they had a kind of party, a scientific party, where everybody gathered in this one house in London, and they had an electric eel, and one person grabbed it on one end and then held hands with 27 other people in a ring and grabbed it on the other end, and the electric shock ran through them all. And that was kind of a kick, kind of a thrill, and also told them something about the natural world that they hadn't known before, that there was this electrical basis for these biological actions.
Well, and of course, that is what is at the heart here of this fervor. Yet, not every species seeker was looking for the exotic, the lion or the electric eel. Tell us about the man who came to be known as Rumphius.
So Rumphius was a Dutch-German character in the 17th century, and he was raised in the middle of the Thirty Years' War and became a mercenary and was miserable, I think, and he fled Europe, got to work for the Dutch East India Company, wound up on an island in Indonesia, and this was really 6 months and more out away from home, and fell in love with the place and the life there, stayed there, married, had children, and became fascinated with the wildlife and didn't just catalog it the way a lot of people did, the species name and the descriptions, but watched how things behaved. So other people were interested in pen shells, which are shaped kind of like a quill pen, because they're pretty. And he was interested enough to watch how they lived on the bottom of a bay. And he saw that within the shell, within the pen shell, there was a little sort of ice-colored shrimp. And when there was something dangerous coming, the shrimp would pinch the shell would close up with the shrimp inside, and so they had this kind of mutual benefit relationship.
We're talking about some of the very colorful early naturalists that changed the human perspective on the world with Richard Conniff. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and a frequent NPR contributor and author of a new book called The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. Well, one of my most favorite chapters in the book talks about the conundrum of what to do with a species once they have been collected. So enter Charles Waterton. How did he come to change this game?
So Charles Waterton was, like a lot of these characters, eccentric. He was a member of the sort of British Catholic gentry and had an estate in Yorkshire. But he went over in the 1820s to South America four times, I think. And he was interested in species not so much to name them, but to bring them back to life, that is, to stuff them and arrange them in a way that actually reflected how they lived in the wild. So he spent enormous amounts of time looking at how a bird sat on a branch, for instance, and then trying to recapture that. And it was kind of like he was interested in reincarnation. So he developed new techniques for preservation, and that up until about the 1820s or 1830s, everything that you collected pretty much rotted away before too long. But about that time, arsenic came in and various other preservatives, and that made it possible to keep these things and build up large collections and make comparisons of one to another. And that really helped people understand a lot more about the natural world.
How did this sudden discovery of so many species affect the predominantly Christian, European, and American vision of God's individual divine creations?
Well, you know, we tend to think of this as a story just about the discovery of evolution by natural selection. And really, it was a lot more profound than that. And one of the big changes happened in the end of the 18th century because of a species that had been discovered in the United States. It was they called it the incognitum, but it was a mastodon. And a French anatomist named Georges Cuvier used the mastodon and other specimens that he had of African elephants and Indian elephants and Siberian mammoths to demonstrate that the mastodon was, in fact, extinct. And that was a pretty profound shock because it meant that a part of God's creation had actually disappeared from the face of the earth. And up until then, everybody believed in this perfect chain of being where from the lowest creature to the highest, everything, every place, every possible place was filled, and everything was sort of designed to stay that way forever. Suddenly, you know, the idea that we could disappear from the face of the earth became something you had to conjure with.
Well, now, we read one of your blog posts in the New York Times. Now, there's a terrific argument for naturalist as spy, something that you note isn't necessarily the way that naturalists view themselves. What is that connection between the two professions?
Well, so naturalists actually hate this connection because it just makes people in countries that they are trying to explore suspicious of them. But, you know, there's a long literature of it, and Stephen Maturin in the novels, sorry, I can't remember the name of the novels right now, but those seagoing novels written by Patrick O'Brien is this sort of typical naturalist surgeon and spy. And the ability to observe things closely in the natural world and note subtle changes over time is actually a kind of a useful skill for spying as well. And so there have been a number of cases where people either have pretended to be naturalists or naturalists have turned their skills to spying.
How many species are left yet to discover?
Well, that's a big subject of debate. So a recent study came out and said that probably we have 10 million species on Earth, so we have another 8 million to go. But others have said 50 million to 100 million. I think the point is that we really, even after 150 years of discovery, 200 years, we know very little of the natural world. And what we don't know about what's disappearing all around us right now could actually be pretty critical information.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I really want to thank you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you, Virginia.
Richard Conniff, a Guggenheim Fellow, winner of the National Magazine Award and guest columnist for the New York Times. His new book is The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. You can find more on the book, including some terrific reviews, at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget that you can seek us on Facebook and on Twitter. No life or limb required. Coming up, a museum exhibits the trickery that keeps Harry Houdini cemented as a legend in the imaginations of millions. We're going to hear about that after this brief escape. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.